So imagine standing on the edge of something great, a new opportunity, a promise ahead. But before stepping forward, there's a choice. Will you trust God fully, or will you fear? And will you doubt, and will complacency hold you back? So that's exactly where Israel stood in the book of Numbers and Deuteronomy as they neared the promised land. See, they faced tests of faith, of leadership struggles, of rebellion, and the challenge of obedience. So today, as we go through our study, we should ask ourselves, are we trusting God and His promises? And are we settling for less? Are we walking in faith? Or are we repeating the mistakes of the past? So for visiting with us, we have been endeavoring to read as a body here the entire Bible using the daily Bible as our source for reading, which places the entire scripture in chronological order and divides it up into daily readings. And so on Sunday mornings, we are having a lesson and a study that covers the readings that we had over the last week. And so we are in Numbers and Deuteronomy this week. That's what the readings covered much of. And the Israelites struggle through the wilderness as they are approaching the promised land. So the lesson can be broken out in a number of different ways. I chose to group it into four main sections. The first dealing with the rebellion and its consequences, so we'll discuss that, and the Israelites' lack of faith, which caused them to miss out on God's promises. Included in that is Korah's rebellion, which showed the danger of challenging God's leadership. Then we'll go into a section on God's provision and the danger of compromise in Numbers chapter 18 and chapter 21 and 22 through 25. And God continually provides for His people even though they're disobedient. And we see that time and time again. And Moses makes a mistake at Meribah. And we have the story of the bronze serpent, which we'll discuss that. And then there's the preparation for the promised land in Numbers 26, 27, 32, 33 through 35. It's a lot to cover there. But there's a new generation now that is being prepared and readied to enter the promised land. We see Joshua appointed as the new leader of the Israelites because, I guess, Moses was moved due to lack of confidence, his ability, and we'll discuss that. And then Moses gives a final warning to the Israelites in Deuteronomy chapter 2 through 4, which I loved because it's wisdom acquired over a lifetime that he's passing on to the people that he loves. It summarizes everything they need to remember and to think about, and all the things that he's sharing with them and telling them apply to us today as God's people. And so it is wisdom, godly wisdom being shared to God's people, and we are God's people, and that we can read it in that way and take those lessons to heart and abide by them as well. So the big question for today's class, then, is are we allowing fear to hold us back, like the Israelites did? Are we making excuses instead of obeying, like the Israelites did? And are we spiritually complacent, forgetting what God has done for us, like the Israelites did? So I encourage you to put yourself in their place, and think of it in that way. So the first group or section that we'd like to cover today has to do with rebellion and its consequences in Numbers chapter 14, 36 through 45, and then Numbers chapters 16 through 17. So God promised the land to Israel, but fear had gripped their hearts. The spies had seen the giants and the fortified cities, and instead of trusting in the God who parted the Red Sea, they chose fear over faith. And because of their unbelief, God had declared that they would wander for 40 years. But some of them said, we can still take the land. Some of them decided that they would take it upon themselves. So they armed themselves and marched forward without God's blessing. And then what happened? What happened to them? How did that work out? It didn't. Going against God's plan doesn't work out. And we see that, just another example of that here. Their strength meant nothing to God. And their disobedience brought about God's judgment. So, Korah's rebellion really is about questioning God's leadership. And we continue to see rebellion after rebellion from the Israelites, and the story with Korah's rebellion is no different. There's a man named Korah, along with 250 others, who rose up against Moses and Aaron. They said, "Who made you ruler over us?" And they demanded, "We are all holy before God." But see, they had forgotten that God had chosen Moses. It was God's will that Moses would be their leader. And so they were rebelling against God's will again. So what did God do? He's not going to let that stand, right? Pretty scary situation, pretty disturbing demonstration of God's wrath. What happened? The earth swallowed them. Yeah, that's on my top five list of ways I don't want to go. I do have a list. It's up there. The earth swallowing me is not one. There's a lot to think about as that's happening. But pretty dramatic display of God's power and wrath and displeasure with their disobedience and their defiance. So the ground split and opened beneath them, swallowing up Korah and his followers alive. Fire fell from heaven and consumed the rest. And to prove once and for all who was chosen, What did God do to Aaron's staff? Made it bud. Yeah, a dead stick. Not in the ground. Would miraculously budded and blossomed and produced almonds, which was a symbol of God's divine authority.
So abide by. And, you know, we kind of have an hindsight thing here, where on one hand, like, the Israelites should know, if Moses is telling them this is from God, they should know this. But at the same time, kind of in the back of mind, say, okay, look, he's choosing his brother. He's got this. So, at the end of the day, this is not from the Israelites. It wasn't handled the right way, obviously. But in the end, what you have is proof that's lasting that you can go into the Ark of the Covenant to show how this Aaron's lineage is from God for him to be the high priest.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's a very good point. So what is the rebellion at Korah, or rebellion of Korah, rather, reveal about rejecting God's leadership, kind of to Tony's point? I mean, what's the lesson for us there? Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely humbling, no doubt, and that we have a place and a relationship with God, but that doesn't make us God or make us in any way equal to Him. We are subservient and subject ourselves to His will. He is sovereign. And He decides, not us. Yeah, no doubt. That was very clear. There was no, the discussion was over, for sure. And kind of to Tony's point about the Aaron's rod and the budding, it was a confirmation of Aaron's leadership. And God's confirmation of it. So there's no doubt what God's will was here in this case. That message was very clear to them. And they had that visceral reminder, that physical reminder of God's will that they maintained and kept sacred. And as a reminder, and they stored it in the ark, so that tells you how important it was to them that they remember it and hold it sacred. Any other comments on that? Yeah, Miller. Yeah, I didn't look that up. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, for sure. Yep, Keith. Yeah, for sure. That is a pretty, and that's an important thread for us because we're learning about, through our study in the Old Testament and the first four books here, we're seeing God revealed in His nature and His desire for His people. And God's nature and His desires for His people, the character that He wants from them, that hasn't changed and will not change. And God isn't changing and will not change. And so what we learn about God and His desires and His will for His people is consistent, and it can be applied to us, and we need to look at it through that lens and constantly seek to understand God's will for us as His people under the new covenant. Any other comments? Yeah, for sure. And sometimes they're immediate and completely apparent, and other times it takes time for them to play out here on this earth, or for sure in eternity. And it's clear sometimes the consequences of your disobedience are felt for generations. And take generations to be completely dealt with, as we will see. So, next kind of section that I grouped here has to deal with God's provision and the dangers of compromise, all covered in mostly Numbers 18 through 31, various chapters. As with regard to provision in the wilderness, throughout all this time, God has never abandoned His people, and He provides for the Levites, ensuring that His house was cared for. And even in judgment, His grace remained. But then there was another test. At Meribah, the people were crying out for water, which is fair. When you don't have water and you're dehydrated and you're thirsty, you need it to survive. And so they likely were fearing for their lives and struggling with not having enough water. And were complaining to Moses, as they do. And Moses, which I empathize with him, he bore the burden of leadership on his shoulders. And likely struggled with, the frustration of having thousands of people complaining to you. I mean, if you can imagine what that is like, and demanding that action be taken. But Moses grew weary and frustrated, and he struck the rock instead of speaking to it as God had commanded. And because of that single act of disobedience, what happened? Yeah. He was denied entrance into the promised land because of that one single act of weakness. So to me, I look at it like he just lost it in the moment. And made a poor decision. I only say that just because I've done that, and I know how that feels when you immediately know after you did it, I messed up. I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have said that in that way. I let my emotions get the better of me, and I messed up. I don't know if that was the case. We don't know for sure all of the circumstances leading up to and what was going on in Moses' head at the time. But we do know that he didn't do what God asked him to do in the exact way that God asked him to do it. And the consequences were severe for him. Yeah, Tony.
That's a great point. And because you didn't glorify you, that was a real thing when I was
You're right.
That it's like, okay, yeah, you struck it when you shouldn't, but you were, all of a sudden you forgot me in this, and we can't have it.
Yeah, no. Let's read that, actually, Numbers 21 through 13. I think it's worth reading that. That's a great point, Tony. That I meant to call out. Numbers 21 through 13. If somebody could read that.
When the sons of Israel, the whole congregation, came to the wilderness then, the first month, people say that Miriam died in the spirit. Now there was no
Yeah, Moses said, "Hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock?" Wasn't Moses doing it. He forgot that, as Tony said. This was God's plan. Moses was a tool that God was using. And Moses, it's pretty clear, he forgot that. And fell into the trappings that the headiness of leadership, you get clouded by power sometimes. That can happen. Where you think you're something special because you're in charge, when in reality, you're not. You're there to serve those who you're looking after. And in this case, God was in charge, and Moses didn't demonstrate that through his words and his deeds here. So let's move on to the bronze serpent story. Not long after Israel grew impatient, saying, "Why have you brought us out here to die?" God sent venomous snakes and serpents into their camp. Not a fan of snakes. This is the worst like study ever, as far as like things I don't like for sure. But snakes, venomous snakes. Not good. Definitely make them rethink their current course of action, having to deal with that. But God still provided and showed mercy on them, and provided them a way out, a way for salvation from the wrath of the snakes. And how did He do that? How did God do that? And I think this is important to discuss. Yeah, they'd be healed. So, strange command, but those who looked lived. And centuries later, Jesus alludes to it in John chapter 3, verse 14. Let's read John 3, verse 14. John 3, 14. So even in judgment at the time, God was pointing them and us to salvation and the ultimate salvation, which is through Jesus. Any other comments on that? Yeah. Yeah, so that's a lesson in and of itself too. That you know, God, not to corrupt what God provides and turn it into something that's counter to what God desires, which is what Greg was alluding to. I mean, it didn't take long for them to turn this bronze serpent into an idol.
Well, I think that I'm about to bring it up because I think there's some great lessons in that. Because in this particular case, I can almost see how the thought process would go over time. This was something that was provided by God. It was a source of salvation. Yeah. Here. So all of a sudden, you can see how that would work.
Oh, sure.
Then we need to worship this because this is a do what God wants. Use it in the way He commands and prescribes to us. And the only way we're going to know what that is if we stay in the book and know what His commands are, so that we do things the way He wants us to do instead of thinking of ourselves starting going off on a thousand things.
Sure. Yeah. No. That's a good point. Any other comments on that, Danny? Great reminder. Staying in the Word, you see that. You're reminded of that over and over and over again. Sure is hard to do when you're in the midst of it. That's the call. So then there was Balaam. This is another crazy lessons and things that we got from the story of Balaam. Balaam was the prophet who knew God's will but still sought personal gain. So he wasn't necessarily a false prophet. He was a corrupt one. That's kind of how I would describe it. I'm getting up and down from Tony, so I'm good. I'm kind of staying in line here with that. At first, he refused to curse Israel. But later, he found another way to corrupt them from within. And so, he's kind of the worst. I say he's the worst. Let me say it this way. He's insidious because he knew how to really get after them and to win by getting them to go against God and to sin against God. Because he couldn't do it outright, he didn't outright defy God, he gave Balak a way to win and to corrupt in a really insidious, devious way, and it's how Satan works in our lives too. By by appearing to be and saying the right things on the outside, but while working behind the scenes in the shadows to find ways to corrupt us and to separate us from God. And he was able to do that successfully here. With the Moabite women who seduced Israel, and they led them into idolatry and immorality, and about 25,000 Israelites died because of it. So Balaam thought he could serve both God and greed, but in the end, he lost everything. He lost it all, and he himself was killed. Any comments and thoughts on that? There's a lot of additional lessons that we can take from that story. I didn't go into the donkey thing. No, and I see myself in Balaam a little bit here with the frustration and the, not that I beat donkeys, I don't, or any animal, but you know, he lost it on the road. Like he was trying to get somewhere, and things were going his way, and he had a little road rage. You know, I guess this is kind of the way you describe it. And, you know, he couldn't see, at first he couldn't see the angel there. He didn't know what was going on. He just knew things weren't going his way. And lost it, as sometimes you can. But he knew he couldn't go against God, and he couldn't curse Israel. Because he knew God had blessed them, and that wasn't going to work out for him, and so he didn't. But Balak was insistent on him. He had faith in Balaam's abilities and what he could deliver on, and so it seems like Balaam likely had some success, which would indicate and make him believe that. Balaam could do what Balak thought he could do. They had some reason to believe that.
The other thing that kind of always strikes me is how short-lived it was. If he did have success, and, it kind of goes away from Balak, thinking, everything's okay. And, chapter 31, he gets killed along with all the Midianites.
Yep.
Yeah,
great lesson for us. There's a lot of decisions we can make here on this earth that will seemingly give us short-term success. There's a lot of things you can compromise on and take shortcuts on and get immediate pleasure and success. Like, there's no doubt about that. Right. Yeah. Because God knows our heart. He knows our intentions. And he knows how it plays out. And can see way more than we can about the impact and the consequences of making wrong decisions and going against his will. Yeah, and the danger still exists for us today. They are everywhere. You do not have to look very far. In fact, open up your phone and they're there, trying to lead us astray. And so we have to remain on guard and in the Word, so that we can recognize it and turn away from it when we see it. Because it's easy to do both of those things, to not recognize it and to not turn away when you do. Both of those are traps that we could fall into as God's people. Any other comments on that? Some things we didn't bring up has to do with and talk about has to do with God's providing for the priests and the Levites. And the lesson for us about supporting God's work today and our role there, and I guess what God desires and requires of His people with regard to supporting His work. And that principle, that common thread from the Old Covenant to the New. You guys have any thoughts on that? I do. So the Levites were set apart and were doing a specific work that God required for His people. And how were they taken care of? How were the Levites provided for? What's that? By the people. Yeah. It was a duty, an obligation for the rest of God's people to provide and support for the Levites in order for God's work to be done and God's will to be done. And the specific things that were required by the Levites, they needed to be provided for. And God set up a way under the Old Covenant here to enable that. And so that aspect, you know, there's obviously, we're not, as under the New Covenant, we're not under the Levitical system. But God still has provided a way for us as His people to see about His work. And that's what we do as Christians. We follow God's word as it's laid out to ensure that His work's being done by laying by and stored, and setting aside provisions to take care of the work that needs to be done. So that's what we do. That's okay.
The Levites, one thing that I found really strong is when Moses came down off the mountain, they were the ones that stood up first. And he told them to take the sword to the camp and just wipe them out, right? Whoever was left, that was, you know, the group that moved on. When the Levites, you know, for us today, like you say, you've got to stay in the Word, and every day, you know, you have to stand up.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't mess with the Levites for sure. they don't play. The Levites don't play. It's pretty apparent. So moving on, there's obviously some preparation that had to take place to enter the Promised Land. Some work was being done, as we can start to see in Numbers 26. A new census was taken, and the old generation had died out in the wilderness, just as God has said. And with them, Moses' time was ending. But God had already chosen a new leader in Joshua. And before all of Israel, Moses laid hands on him, passing on the mantle of leadership. So Israel was ready, almost, because two tribes, Reuben and Gad, saw the land outside of Canaan and said, "This is good enough for us." They Moses warned them not to settle there unless you fight alongside your brothers. And they agreed, but even then they settled for less than the full promise of God. And so I guess that the question for us is, are we ever guilty of that, of stopping short of what God had promised? So why was it necessary for Israel to take a new census in Numbers 26? Like, there's a lot of reasons why they needed to do that. I think some of the reasons was, well, it's been, you know, there's a new generation there since those 20 years and older have left Egypt. So many had perished in the wilderness. So the census was a fresh start with a new generation that would enter and conquer the land. So there's also aspects of the tribal inheritance. So they were going to divide the land up by tribes, and you know, larger tribes got more land. So you had to know how big the tribe was so you can figure out how much land that they were going to get. There's also a leadership transition going on. So Joshua was taken over. He needed to know what he was taken over of. So a part of getting things ready for the new leader to come in and take over. You want to get your house in order. You want to present it all, everything clean and orderly when you hand it over. And it was a reminder of God's faithfulness. And it was a fulfillment of God's promise to preserve Israel and bring them into the land despite the past failures. Because God is faithful to His promises ultimately. And His plans will continue from generation to generation. Despite their disobedience. God's promise is true. They will become a great nation, and they are becoming a great nation, and they will get reap the promise of the land. But if they're disobedient along the way, it's not going to be everybody, as was clear through our study. So God's still fulfilling His promises, but with the next generation. So why did Reuben and Gad request land outside of Canaan? Why did they want that? And what was the problem with that? Right. Yeah, the land looked good for their flocks. They still had to be a part of the larger family and the struggles that they faced. They weren't completely absolved from that. I mean, I think there's a lesson there about trusting God's plan for us and making sure that we don't think something is better than what God had promised. I think that's the risk for us, is that we have a promise of eternal life, but there's a lot of things that look great and fun and neat here on earth. And if we think, well, our reward, we can just take it now. What are we potentially giving up? The ultimate reward, God's true promise. And so, and sometimes it's not bad. There's plenty of things that we can enjoy as a people here on earth that won't necessarily condemn us, but it can definitely take us away from our focus on God and the eternal reward and what's required of that. So I guess my point is partial obedience can lead to future problems. And it doesn't take completely turning away. It's just going a little off course. And over time, you're in the wrong spot. Yeah.
Well, the biggest lesson for me, the biggest thing I take away from this is just not being complacent in our relationship with God or finishing this race. And really not being comfortable. That I know enough about the Bible, that I'm doing what I need to do every day, but really doing my best to be talking to God, staying close to God, and not just being in His Word, and setting aside time to pray, meditate.
When you look at what the prophecies were, what God said the boundaries of the promised land would be, this part of the land was included in that. Because it wasn't, He didn't say I'm going to take you from the Mediterranean to the Jordan. This would be crazy. Part of the land, maybe, and this is maybe why Moses told him what he did, and that, okay, you're not done. They got, in a way, they got ahead of themselves, but when you look later on, what are they doing? They're casting lots for the land to see who gets what. So, in a way, they got ahead of themselves in the sense of, we want this one instead of letting things play out and seeing how the lot can be passed.
Yep.
But again, they weren't condemned for it. It was like, hey, you need to see it through.
So we don't have time. Obviously, we're out of time. But in Deuteronomy 2-4, we give Moses' final warnings. If you haven't got to that section yet, I encourage you to do that because it's an encouragement to us today. And then the last slide I have really has to do just kind of a summary of the lessons for us and the questions that we should ask ourselves: Are we going to choose faith or fear, obedience or rebellion, or the wilderness, remain in the wilderness, or seek and after the reward and the promises that God makes. Thanks for your attention.